shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
I am going to start with a question. What is the source of the biblical creation narrative in Genesis when it says, divided into six evenings and mornings? The most outstanding literary problem is the beginning of Genesis, and the precise meaning of the 6 days separated as they are from each other by an evening and a morning. In addition, there is also the problem of the rest on the seventh day. These days have been a problem with almost everyone who has read the narrative of creation. Were they days of 24 hours each, or can they be interpreted as though long periods of time were intended? Why are these days separated from each other by an evening and a morning? In whatever way these questions are answered, it is obvious that the record implies that God did something for 6 days and ceased doing it on the seventh day. What did God do on those 6 days, and why did he cease on the seventh? The answer given most by those who regard the Bible as trustworthy is that God created or recreated the world on those 6 days and rested on the seventh. However, whether the meaning of the word day is literal or symbolic, such an answer is not in accordance with the facts. It not only disagrees with the Bible, but also with science. And with all we know now about the literary methods of writing in ancient times, the Genesis narrative, when accepted in its natural ancient writing form, can be shown to be in perfect harmony with the Bible and science. However, probably no passage in the Scriptures has been subjected to such detailed, continuous, and critical examination as the first chapter of Genesis. Most of the criticism originated before scholars were aware of the early literary methods revealed by modern archaeological discoveries. In the light of these discoveries, one can see how the creation narrative agrees with the ascertained facts of science, disagrees with some scientific theories. Scientific investigations have revealed to the astronomer the mechanism of the universe, to the geologist new methods of interpreting the record of the rocks, to the biologist a new look about life and its manifestations, to paleographers, that is, experts in ancient writings, a more exact understanding concerning the origin of meaning of ancient words and languages, and to the archaeologist new discoveries about ancient things and people. Some have imagined that the growth of scientific knowledge has dealt a death blow to the scriptural account or narration of creation. However, this is not the case. Actually, archaeological evidence keeps coming to light that confirms the narrative of creation. As the basis for this study, I start with the following reasonable conviction. 1. There is a God. 2. He is the creator of the heavens and the earth. 3. He could, if needed, reveal to man something about creation. I am going to start where the narrative of creation begins. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And like the Bible, accept that statement that God was the creator. From the Bible point of view, Christians accept the fact that God not only could, but did reveal himself to man, but the methods of his creation, or the length of time occupied by him in his acts or processes, is not given. For this study, we will deal not with the problem of how God created the universe and life on earth, but rather we will deal with the literary problem of the origin of the narrative and its meaning, especially the meaning of the 6 days. The account of creation in the first chapter of Genesis is written in a literary form quite unlike any other narrative in the Bible. Not only is it divided into 6 sections by the use of the words, and there was evening and there was morning, but the sections are serially numbered from 1 to 6. The whole record is fitted into a unique framework composed of words and phrases which are repeated 6 or more times. The main elements of the words and phrases which are repeated in the account for each day are as follows. Day 1, verse 3, God said, let, and was. Verse 4, God saw that it was good. God divided. Verse 5, God called, and there was evening, and there was morning, day 1. Day 2, verse 6, God said, let. Verse 7, God made. God divided, and it was so. Verse 8, God called. God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning, day 2. Day 3, verse 9, God said, let, and it was so. Verse 10, God called. God saw that it was good. Verse 11, God said, let, and it was so. Verse 12, God saw that it was good. Verse 13, and there was evening, and there was morning, day 3. Day 4, verse 14, God said, let, and it was so. Verse 16, God made. Verse 17, God set. Verse 18, God saw that it was good. Verse 19, and there was evening, and there was morning, day 4. Day 5, verse 20, God said, let, and it was so. Verse 21, God created. God saw that it was good. Verse 22, God blessed. Verse 23, and there was evening, and there was morning, day 5. Day 6, verse 24, God said, let, and it was so. Verse 25, God made. God saw that it was good. Verse 26, God said, let. Verse 27, God created. God created, created. Verse 28, God blessed. God said. Verse 29, God said, and it was so. And verse 31, God saw that it was very good, and there was evening and was morning, day 6. Apart from the repetition of the phrases, the words are remarkably few and simple. If this record of creation is carefully examined, it will be seen that the 6 days fall into 2 clearly parallel parts. The events recorded in the last 3 days being parallel with the first 3 days. For example, on the first day, it was revealed how light came into existence. On the 4th day, about the sources and purposes of the light. The greater light for the day and the lesser light for the night. On the 2nd day, God explains how the atmosphere came to be and how it separated the waters above from those below the expanse. On the 5th day, how the waters below were populated with fish and the atmosphere with birds. On the 3rd day, God tells how he gathered the waters together so as to form dry land, and then how the various forms of vegetation came to be. On the 6th day, it is said how the dry land was populated with animal life, how man was created, and explains how the first of the forms of green vegetation was for animal life, and both green vegetation and trees were assigned to man for food. It is significant that the only references to the 6 days of work and 1 of rest in connection with the narrative of creation are those relating to the 4th commandment. In no other connection in the Bible are the 6 days mentioned. The 4th commandment required that mankind should work for 6 days and rest on the 7th, because God did something for 6 days and ceased doing it on the 7th. The 4th commandment says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days thou shalt labor and do all thy work, but the 7th day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work. And continuing on, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them is, and rested the 7th day. The impression conveyed by this passage is of ordinary days. But this does not agree with science, which reveals that for millions of years, the slow process of world-making has been going on, with reference to the physical structure and to the lower grades of living creatures. If the days are interpreted as geological periods of unknown length, then the explanation does what those who adopt it desire it to do, enables Genesis to be reconciled with science. But does the scriptures even suggest this? It does not say that the 6 days of creation meant extended periods of time. Anyway, the extended time theory fails to deal with the 6 evenings and mornings. It either ignores or fails to make any reasonable interpretation of them. Was each of them an indefinitely long night in which there was no light? Was the geological night as long or almost as long as the geological day? The words evening and morning seem very unnatural to describe such a geological night. Was there any sense of an evening and morning in that kind of a day? Another theory is that the 6 days was a recreation, a theory that there had been 2 quite distinct creations and that these were separated by an unknown period lasting possibly millions of years. It interprets the first chapter of Genesis, the first sentence. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and is presumed to be in a complete account, or at least all we are told about the first or original creation of the heaven and the earth. The theory assumes that plant, animal, and human life were included in that creation, notwithstanding that no mention is made of the creation of life until later in the chapter. The second verse is said to leave room for, or to assume, that a catastrophe came upon the earth affecting the sun and the moon, resulting in the earth becoming darkness and waters, chaos and ruin, involving the destruction of all plant, animal, and human life. The remaining verses, 3 verse to 31, are said to refer to the 6 literal days in which God recreated the earth. The light is made to appear again, the waters that covered the earth made to recede, so that dry land appeared and all plant, animal, and human life are recreated. All this in 6 ordinary days of 24 hours each. This theory then assumes that chapter 2, verses 1 to 4, only refers to the second or recreation period. They point out that the second verse of Genesis describes the earth as a ruin, but there is no hint of the time which elapsed between creation and this ruin. Age after age may have rolled away, and it was probably during their course that the strata of the earth's crust were gradually developed. There is room for any length of time between the first and second verses of the Bible. This theory came about because of the impossibility of compressing the geological formation of the earth into a period of 6 ordinary days, and it is true that the events of verse 2 could be a vast number of millions of years. But the theory, while it provides for the long periods required by geology, and also adheres to the scriptural narrative as to the literalness of the 6 days, but it gives no satisfactory reason for the evening and mornings. Yet another theory is that the Genesis narrative is mythological or legendary in character and does not merit serious consideration as a reputable historical document. But this theory does not give a satisfactory explanation as to why it is written without mythological or legendary elements. However, all these theories and explanations fail to determine in a complete and reasonable way what God did for 6 days and why he ceased on the 7th day. Some might point out that the 4th commandment says, "For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the 7th day. That is how the Authorized Version reads, but is this correct? In the Hebrew version of Genesis, we find that the word "in" does not appear, and the early translation of the Septuagint omits the word "the seas." Furthermore, the word "seventh" is found instead of the word "Sabbath." The word translated "rested," like the same word in Genesis 2, simply means ceased or desisted. it does not necessarily mean rest or relaxation. In Arabic, the word sababtu means to cut off or to interrupt. In Assyria, it means to cease. In the fourth commandment, the word translated work from malach simply refers to ordinary work or occupation, a term that does not present the idea of creation. The word translated made must be understood correctly because the meaning of the passage, which has caused so much difficulty, is dependent upon the sense in which it is used in this verse. It is translated from the Hebrew word asah, spelled A-S-A-H, which is used over 2,500 times in the Old Testament. Of these, more than 1,500 times, it is a translated do or did. The word itself does not in any way explain what the person did or what was done. In verse 11, it means to make or yield fruit. In 2 Samuel 19, verse 24, means to dress or trim a beard. In spite of such a great latitude of meaning and application, there has been a tendency to elevate its meaning in the fourth commandment to the equivalent of the word created. In reality, the scriptures only state that God did something, and what God did on the 6 days can only be determined by the context in which the word appears. One thing is quite clear. The fourth commandment does not use the word bara, meaning create, or say that God created the heaven and the earth in 6 days. A literal translation of this fourth commandment should read, "For in 6 days the Lord did the heavens and the earth, and rested the seventh day." We should be asking what the Lord did for 6 days and why he rested on the seventh day, instead of incorrectly assuming that during the 6 days he was creating the earth. If one questions this interpretation of the Hebrew word asah, let me quote some of the translations as they appear in the Authorized Version of the Bible. I'll accentuate the verb translated from the word asah. Genesis 18, verse 8, the calf he had dressed. Genesis 24, verse 9, thou hast done deeds unto me. Verse 10, that thou hast done this thing. Genesis 21, verse 23, kindness which I have done unto thee. Genesis 27, verse 17, the savory meat and bread which she had prepared. Exodus 19, verse 4, you have seen what I did unto the Egyptians. Exodus 23, verse 22, obey his voice and do all that I speak. It is obvious that in such an instance as Genesis 23, verse 8, the word asah is not intended to convey the idea that Abraham either created or made the calf he was preparing for a meal. Other translations of the word asah are as follows. Reading Genesis 6, verse 19, which thou hast showed. Genesis 14, verse 14, thou hast showed kindness. Genesis 32, verse 10, the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant. Judges 6, verse 17, then show me a sign that thou talkest with me. If the fourth commandment had been similarly translated, it would have read, for in 6 days the Lord showed the heavens and the earth and all that in them is, and rested on the seventh day. The early Israelites felt required to work 6 days and cease work on the seventh, only because God did something for 6 literal days and ceased on the seventh. There is not the slightest indication or any impression given that there had been some miracle of speed in creation, or that the Creator of the heavens and the earth needed a day of rest after 6 days of work, nor is there any indication that the 6 days referred to 6 long geological ages. Or that creation was accomplished in a limited period of time, or that it relates to a second creation or to 6 literal days of recreation. Now we come to the question, if God was not creating the heavens and the earth during these 6 days, then what was he doing? And why did God need a rest on the seventh day? I'll take the second question first. Did God really need a rest after what he did for 6 days? Obviously he did not. In Isaiah 40 verse 28, we read that God the Lord, the creator of the universe, fainteth not, neither is weary. So the seventh day was not for the benefit of God, but was for man. Mark 21 verse 27 declares that the Sabbath was made for man. Thus it follows that the seventh day rest was for the sake of man. Regarding what God did for those 6 days, it is obvious that the mission of evening and morning, in those apparently six literal days, that God was doing something with man during each of those 6 days, and not creating the heavens and the earth, as is commonly taught by Bible scholars. When God called light out of darkness, when he made the atmospheric firmament, when he caused the waters to recede and dry land appear, man was not there to know about it. Evenings and mornings were unknown. Man had not yet been created. The activities of the days in the first chapter of Genesis cannot therefore refer to the period of time occupied by God in the creation. Those six nightly periods of rest, as well as the seventh day of rest, were introduced after man had been created. Consequently, the first page of the Bible must refer to the 6 days during which God did something in relationship to creation after man was on the earth. What God was doing was saying something about creation to man. Notice, each of those 6 days commenced with the words, God saith, or said. Or in other words, God on each of the separate days gave an account of what he had made, a revelation about his creative acts in times past. So 6 days occupied by God in revealing to man the story of creation. We are told what God said on the first day about the separation of light from darkness. Then came the evening and morning. The second day God said how, in a past time, he had made the atmosphere with its waters below and above it. And on the third day how he caused the waters to recede so that dry land appeared. This first part of Genesis is a narrative of what God said to man, and there is no suggestion that the acts or processes of God had occupied those 6 days. During the daylight hours of each of those 6 days, God told man how, in an age past, he had commanded and it stood fast, referring to creation, in such a simple way that man could understand how he had created the world and introduced life upon it. Another significant thing should be noticed. At the time God said to man about creation, he gave names to the things he spoke about. On the first day he called the light day, and the darkness he called night. On the second day, when telling about the firmament, he called it heaven. And then on the third day God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called the seas. One might be thinking, why did God give names to those things? And why should God tell man about creation? In regards to the first question, the supposition that God gave names to things before man had been created has been a great perplexity to all Bible commentators. However, when we understand that the names were given for man's sake, this difficulty disappears. In answer to the second question, God needed to tell man about creation because it was a subject that man could not find out for himself, and he should not be, in the early days, be left to grope in the darkness concerning the origin and significance of created things around him. It is interesting to note that creation in the Scriptures appears as an inspiration to worship. As the psalmist wrote, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork." Such words fill the mind of man with adoring thoughts of God. Because the 6 days have been misunderstood as though they were periods occupied by God in his creative acts, instead of just the time occupied by him revealing what he had created in the infinite past, the first page of Genesis has been a stumbling block to many readers of the Bible. Such a misunderstanding may not have mattered greatly in past centuries, but now there is a serious conflict between the interpretations made by Christians of God's words and by scientists of God's works. Questions as how there have been days, evenings, and mornings before the sun and moon were functioning in relationship to the earth are now answered. Science and the Bible do agree. Much has been written about this alleged conflict between interpretations of the narrative of creation and the opinions of scientists. However, the conflict is not between the Bible and science, but between some popular interpretations of the Bible and the speculative theories of science. It should be realized that the Bible and science are not necessarily alternate methods of explaining origins. It is not that one must be true and the other false. Neither is it rational to reject the one in order to accept the other. Science can render valuable service by discrediting an explanation of the text of Genesis, which is based upon unjustifiable assumptions and consequently not valid. And scriptures can also be used to move sciences from a false philosophy developed beyond the bounds of true scientific research, which denies that the universe had a creator and a sustainer, and that the process of creation owes nothing to a creator. Christians owe much to scientific research, and as the English historian Sir John Seeley of Christ College at Cambridge wrote in 1889, that the God worshipped by astronomers and the geologists, dwelling as they do in the immensities of space and time, is greater and more wonderful than the God of the average Christian. Undoubtedly, the scientist who acknowledges God as a creator has a more adequate conception of the works of creation. To summarize, the 6 days of Genesis are intended to be literal days, yes, in which God told man what he had done in creating the world, and not days of creating. And the geological interpretation that the earth is an extremely old planet is valid. Science and the Bible are compatible. Consequently, there should be no disagreement between science and the scriptures. Conflict only takes place where a theory is adopted, which asserts that God was not the creator. As the Apostle John wrote, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him. Without Him was not anything made that was made." Paul in the New Testament asserts, "For by Him were all things created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible. All things were created by Him and for Him, and He is before all things, and by Him all things consist." And in Hebrew wrote, "His Son, whom He hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also He made the worlds. And Thou, Lord, in the beginning hast laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of Thine hands." John the Revelator wrote, "Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for Thou hast created all things, and for Thy pleasure they are and were created. Him that liveth forever and ever, who created heaven and all the things therein are, and earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein. I have found the flood." Those words were flashed around the world. A message sent by Professor Leonard Woolley of the University of Pennsylvania in 1929. At Kish and Ur, Woolley's diggers discovered a layer of solid clay and declared they had come to the bottom of everything. Sent back by Woolley to continue digging, they found the clear clay continued without a change until it had attained a thickness of a little over 8 feet. Then, as suddenly as it had begun, it stopped, and they encountered once more layers of rubbish, stone implements, and pottery. The great bed of clay marked, if it did not cause, a break in the continuity of history, a flood that must have been of a magnitude unparalleled in local history. A whole civilization, which existed before, was submerged by the waters. The conclusion at that time was, there could be no doubt that the flood was the flood upon which the story of Noah was based. Orthodoxy has held until this day to the belief that the deluge of Genesis was universal, covering the whole globe. However, such a belief, although apparently expressed by the Bible translators, is accordingly to the careful analysis of certain facts of Scripture an impossibility. I won't recount the biblical story of the flood. That story is well known. Instead, I want to point out biblical passages that contradict the so-called whole earth flooded theory. The 10th and 11th chapters of Genesis gives us the register of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth, quote, "For they had sons born to them after the deluge." This quote is from the Farrar Fenton translation of the Bible, which is expressed in modern English. And the fifth verse reads, "From these they spread themselves amongst the Gentiles," meaning heathen, "tribes." Verses 31 and 32 reads, "These are the sons of Shem by their tribes and by their language in the countries among the heathen. The above were the families of the sons of Noah and their descendants by tribes. From them they spread themselves among the nations on the earth after the flood." These verses clearly give us to understand that the sons of Noah spread themselves among the existing heathen nations of that time, and by their mental and physical superiority, subdued and mastered them. Some fundamentalists will quote the scriptures which states, "The earth was covered and all flesh died." However, the scriptures also states in Luke 2, they quote, "All the world should be taxed." What was meant by that order was that all the world under Roman rule should be taxed. Rome's rule did not extend into China or Africa. When Genesis therefore speaks of the flood covering the earth, it means that part of the earth in which the Adamites lived who sinned against God. The Mongols and the Negroes did not know God's laws. It should be pointed out that the seventh chapter of Genesis, when it is talking about the flood, wherever it says that the flood covered the earth, the Hebrew word used in the original writings by Moses is eretz, meaning the land or a particular area. Eretz can also be translated ground. Consider this. When Cain was driven off the face of the earth, again the word is eretz, was it the whole earth? Obviously not. That other nations were not affected by a universal flood, but only a local one, is noted in their histories and traditions. Wang Hewang, a Chinese historian, wrote, "Formerly, the heavens rained down incessantly, the wind blowing from the northeast, and the ocean overflowing the land submerged the country and obliterated the course of the nine rivers." Here we have a connection between the conditions of the deluge and inundation of part of China. An ancient tradition of East Turkestan, known as the Tarim Basin, mentions a deluge which overwhelmed 40 cities of the Taklam Makan. The area became a wasteland only in the 3rd century B.C. did human habitation begin again. Then after a few centuries, the sands of the crumbling Pishan mountain range and the Gobi Desert covered the area, leaving it barren and desolate. The gigantic dunes of the Taklam Makan may hide a forgotten civilization. While the date given for the flood in the margin of most English Bibles is 2349 B.C., it can be shown that that date is nearly 8 centuries in error. Usher's datings of the flood is taken from the Masoretic text of the Bible. That we now have evidence was tampered with when written between 100 and 300 A.D. It is noted that 100 years was subtracted from the periods of the patriarchs between Adam and Noah, which when corrected would bring the date of the flood back to 3145 B.C., a date that is found in the Septuagint text of the Bible, written before Christ. A further corruption is found in the Masoretic text, in that it, in some instances, the periods of the patriarchs between Noah and Abraham were also shortened by 100 years. In many of these instances, the Samaritan text and the histories of Josephus also have the longer periods. The Tarim Basin, about 1,000 miles in length, may be the landlocked Adamic earth situated in a valley of the Pamir Plateau. A possible scenario has a mighty seismic disturbance, bringing about the collapse of the Adamic Earth with the great deluge that brought about a great change to the original paradise, raising it into the highest plateau on Earth, and thus changing its climate. When its highest mountain peaks were covered, water overflowed into the surrounding countries and stranded Noah's Ark on Ararat, a name that means the highest peak or peaks. Later, when Noah and his family left the Ark and migrated west into the plains of Shinar, and the story of the flood was told, the people of that country in after years imagined that the Ark rested on their high peak and named the mount Ararat. So also did the historical Euphrates River derive its name from the eastern stream of Edom. Much in the same way the English and Dutch settlers in America brought names of their fatherland with them. After the flood, Noah and his sons and descendants spread themselves over various parts of the earth, as the Bible relates. It should be noted that there is evidence which indicates that enterprising adventurers of the Adamites left their Asiatic mountain home centuries before the flood and established colonies in various parts of the earth, mostly on seacoasts, each developing their own language. These, of course, survived Noah's flood, as did the descendants of the earlier pre-Adamites in Africa and Eastern Asia. Through the line of Shem, who was a father of the children of Heber, came the Hebrew people. One branch, the sons of Enoch, were the progenitors of the ancient Hebrew Phoenicians, a term I use for lack of a better name. They easily took the leading part. Their advanced state of scientific achievements is found in early Chaldea, particularly in mathematics and astronomy, which accounts for the famous astrology of the Chaldeans. These early Chaldean priests were genuine astronomers. They knew the accurate value of the solar year, divided the day into 24 hours, and the circle into 360 degrees. Their months consisted of 30 days each. They knew the 12 signs of the zodiac, and from its constellations developed their famous astrology. Interesting to note, the human faces of their zodiacal constellations show the zodiac did not originate in Chaldea, nor Egypt, nor India, but with the earliest Adamites, for their faces depicted pure Aryan Hebrew, much like the Anglo-Saxons of today. The priests of Egypt also had knowledge of the rudiments of astronomy and knew certain astronomical values. The existence of certain values connected with the precession of the equinoxes is noted by modern scholars, and it shows while the Egyptians and Indians had rules and methods of calculations, they did not know the principles that formed the basis of their calculations. This only indicated that they, as well as the Chinese and Chaldean astronomy, was but inherited from the earlier Adamite Semites. One might ask, can we find any biblical correlation that the flood took place in the Tarim Basin of eastern Turkestan? The answer is yes, by using a little deduction. Genesis 3, verse 24 tells us that Adam and Eve were driven out of the Garden of Eden and that God placed cherubim with flaming swords at the east side of the garden to keep Adam and Eve from returning and having access to the tree of life. If this guard was to accomplish anything, it must have been placed between Adam and the garden. This would indicate that Adam and Eve were driven out to the east. Bible scholars who believe the entire earth was covered by the floodwaters point out the statement in the scriptures in Genesis 7, verse 19 that reads, "And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth," the word here is again, Eretz, "and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered." While it may sound as if the flood was universal, it is not necessarily so. For the expression, quote, "under the whole heaven," unquote, is often used in a limited way. In Deuteronomy 2, verse 25, the same wording is used. "The nations which are under the whole heaven, which is obviously limited in context to a few Canaanite tribes in one small area of the world. Expressions such as "walled up to heaven," as found in Deuteronomy 1, verse 28, and "the end of heaven," found in Isaiah 13, verses 5 and 7, are obviously not to be taken in a literal sense. A better interpretation would have the viewer seeing from one place, from horizon to horizon, and no reason to suppose this would include hills thousands of miles away on the other side of the planet. If the universal flood viewpoint was true, that all the mountains of the world were covered by water, this would place the level of the flood 15 cubits above Mount Everest, the highest mountain in the world. Mount Everest is 29,028 feet. A flood 15 cubits above this would require about 29,050 feet of water above normal sea level. If it rained 40 days and nights, this would work out to about 726 feet of rain a day, or 30 feet per hour, or 6 inches of rain per minute, or an inch of rain every 10 seconds. This is about 8,712 inches of water per day. Even the advocates of a universal flood admit they have a problem. Reading from one of their publications, the Genesis Flood, quote, "If global rain continued for 40 days, as described in the Bible, would have required a different mechanism for its production than is available at the present day. If all the water in our present atmosphere were suddenly precipitated, it would only suffice to cover the ground to an average depth of less than 2 inches." Unquote. The next problem with a universal flood is what became of the water when the flood subsided. Genesis 7, verse 20 and 8, verse 4 and 5 imply the water receded at the rate of 15 cubits in 74 days. If we figure the cubit at approximately 18 inches, the water level dropped 270 inches during this time, or approximately 4 inches a day. If the flood depth was 29,050 feet, which is 348,600 inches, and the water dropped 4 inches a day, it would take 87,150 days to get back to normal sea level. That would be about 239 years, a far cry from the year duration of the flood. These figures suggest that the flood was a regional and not universal. In Genesis 8, verse 13, we read, "The waters were dried up from off the earth," again, Erez. Well, since about over 70% of the earth's surface is water, and if the entire earth is meant, then the waters drying up from off the earth would even include the oceans. The Bible states that the land that was flooded was dried up. Again, I point out that the word earth comes from the Hebrew word eretz, which Strong's Concordance lists as one of its meaning a particular country. Taken in that translation of Strong's Concordance, we have a local flood, and the problems I have outlined disappear. Advocates of a universal flood have another problem when it comes to the animals gathered to go into the ark. A universal flood would require the inclusion of a pair of every single kind of animal in the world. That means giraffes from Africa, polar bears from Alaska, giant pandas from China, and kangaroos from Australia. However, it is more practical and logical that the animals gathered within the ark came from animals threatened by the vast but local area where Noah lived. This lessens the number of animals taken into the ark. A universal flood has another problem, the space within the ark. In Genesis 6, verse 15, the Bible gives the dimensions of the ark as 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. Again, allowing a cubit to be 18 inches, this would make the ark 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. Would an ark this size be large enough to provide room for pairs of all the animals of the entire world, of every beast, fowl, and creeping thing, well over 2 million in number. Now consider the sizes of the various animals. An African elephant may be 12 feet high, with tusks 10 feet long and weigh 7 tons. A rhinoceros reaches 11 feet in length, plus a mane horn that may extend another 4 feet. A giraffe, the tallest living animal, reaches a height of about 20 feet. Crocodiles range from 14 to 16 feet, and giant tortoises can reach 4 feet and weigh over 500 pounds. The list of animals could go on and on. And keep in mind that Noah had to take not only one male and one female into the ark, but in some cases took 7 males and 7 females. Genesis 7, verse 2 reads, "Of every clean beast thou shalt take to thee by sevens, the male and female." 7 pairs is the wording of most translations. Obviously, Noah could not take 3.5 males and 3.5 females. So this means that the number of clean animals should be multiplied by 14. Now consider that the animals designated clean were those that were clean for sacrifices. For after the flood, according to Genesis 8, verse 20, Noah took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Well, now there are five kinds of animals considered clean for sacrifice in the Bible. Cattle, goats, sheep, doves, and pigeons. This is found in Leviticus 1, verse 5. If we consider the meaning of clean to also include those creatures that were clean to be eaten, according to Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14, the numbers on the ark mount even higher. We should consider the question of possible reproduction, demanding additional space and food. For example, a female rabbit can reproduce 5 to 7 litters per year, her gestation period being 28 to 31 days. Other animals that have gestation periods of less than a year, who consequently could have given birth during the time on the ark, include the following: bear, cow, sheep, tiger, dogs, guinea pigs, hamsters, and possums. One could argue that perhaps by divine arrangement, no reproduction took place during the year the animals were on the ark. This argument would not hold because some creatures do not live a full year. Unless they reproduce during that time, none of their kind would have been alive to reproduce after the flood was over. We are talking about ants, bees, cockroaches, crickets, flies, grasshoppers, locusts, and mosquitoes. If these creatures did not reproduce and have a lifespan of less than a year, how is it they are in the world today? There is also a problem for Noah. Since he was to collect a male and female of every species, how could he distinguish between male and female snakes, ants, termites, snails? There are some 5 million species of insects alone. While space was not a problem, sorting them out would be. Again, a local flood solves this dilemma. Another problem with a universal flood is the provisions of food for the animals. Many animals require survival by eating other animals. For example, one sheep may be sufficient meat for 2 wolves for 3 days. This works out to be about 122 sheep for the year in the ark. And mind you, these sheep have to be fed during the entire year. Just the grass or feed alone to sustain the sheep would take up considerable space. Another example is a mongoose, that is a snake eater. For it to remain alive during the year on the ark, it would require a good supply of snakes that would have to be carried, and they in turn would require a supply of lizards to eat to survive. The lizards in turn would require a supply of other insects to eat. Now consider that a lion's favorite food is zebra. Leopards eat antelopes, monkeys, and dogs. Cats eat birds. Birds eat worms. It is really impossible to correctly estimate how many extra zebras, antelopes, monkeys, dogs, and birds, and worms would be required for all the meat-eating animals. It has been suggested that God caused the animals to hibernate during the flood and consequently did not require food. However, this cannot be the case, for Genesis 6 verse 21 states that Noah was told to take food for himself and the animals. Speaking of food, an elephant consumes daily about 44 pounds of grain, 66 pounds of hay, and over 50 pounds of vegetables. At 160 pounds of food a day, this would be 57,600 pounds during the year on the ark. Double this for the male and female elephant. Even the smaller animals must have food to survive. A cow consumes about 20 pounds of hay and 50 pounds of silage a day, or about 25,550 pounds for the year on the ark. Double this for its mate, and then add for 14 of these 7 bulls and 7 cows. We come up with over 357,700 pounds of food, and we have not even considered the many species of cows and all the other animals that must be fed. One estimate would be about 191,000 tons of food alone. Keep in mind, some of these animals require food from other faraway countries. Giant pandas of China are almost exclusively bamboo eaters. The principal source of food for the giraffe is the acacia tree. The koala of Australia feed exclusively on the leaves of the cecropia tree. Obviously, Noah could not travel to distant lands to get food for all these animals. We have not considered water. One would think at first that was no problem. Water, water everywhere. But was it drinkable? It has been calculated that about 8 times the amount of water in all the oceans would be required to cover the earth and its highest peaks. If we take the same ratio, that is, take 8 parts of water and add 1 part ocean water, the result is a water still unfit to drink. So provisions would have to have been made to carry fresh water for the animals, as well as Noah's family. If so, let's estimate the amount of water needed for just the 2 elephants. About 48 gallons of water daily, which adds up to about 36,500 gallons of water for the year. This is about 152,000 tons weight. And we are only talking about 1 pair of animals. Now, what about water living creatures? Universal flood advocates say they could have lived through the flood period in the waters. However, what about those creatures that cannot spend much of their time in the water, such as seals, crocodiles, and some white rhinos cannot survive in a dry cage? Also, many species of fishes require total fresh water, and many require different temperatures to exist, as do different species of animals. One could go on and on with the many problems a universal flood causes. Now, if you are wondering if I believe Noah's flood really took place, the answer is emphatically yes. It took place exactly as the Bible tells us. Just the place and extent the waters covered have been misunderstood. Just as Willie misunderstood at first that he found the flood evidence in Ur, later when he found contemporary settlements matching those above and below the 8-foot bed of clay lined one on top of the other, this is in high ground above the floodplain of the Euphrates Valley. But these had no clay separation. He realized then he was dealing with a local flood, perhaps what we would call a 100-year or more flood. I am not alone in my conclusions the flood was of limited area. Let me quote from 2 recognized authoritative sources. The Interpreter's Bible states, quote, "A universal flood would be a physical impossibility," unquote. And Hastings' Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics states, quote, "The belief in a universal deluge has long been abandoned by well-informed writers," unquote. In this study, I have attempted to reconcile the Bible and science by removing the impossibilities and improbabilities connected with the flood story that have caused me to become cynical or agnostic concerning the authenticity of the Bible. For example, How could species of all the animals on Earth be contained inside the ark, whose limited dimensions can easily be shown, as I have done so, to be inadequate? Simple. Noah had only to take aboard the animals, igneous, to the area of the flood. This would eliminate most of the larger animals, like elephants and lions and so forth, of the African continent, fishes and insect life scattered in other parts of the earth and so forth. And one last problem I will bring up is the scattering of the animals and creatures from the ark after the flood. I am thinking of the slow-moving snail that travels at a top speed of only 0.03 miles per hour. I don't mean to sound facetious, but it would take several thousand years for one to reach California, and that traveling in a straight line without stopping, up and down mountain ranges and valleys, and swimming the Atlantic Ocean. However, they didn't have to. Snails were here all the time, before and after the flood. Our God, in His infinite wisdom, didn't create the problems as I've outlined, but planned the flood in minute detail to cover only a particular portion of the earth, to save the species indigenous to the area, and ordered an ark to be built to the size that accommodate the correct number of animals and creatures to be contained therein, a number that could be properly managed and cared for by Noah and his family. Those who argue for a universal flood are well-meaning in their zeal to prove, as they put it, the scriptures. However, in doing so, they do a great disservice to the Bible. Genesis does not require us to believe that the flood covered the entire globe. I would like to acknowledge that calculations regarding the required water to cover the earth, the amount and weight of the food required by the animals, and so forth, was taken from the works of Ralph Woodrow in his publication, The Noah's Flood, published in 1984.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you were fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com, type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.